imagine for a second that you wake up tomorrow morning.
Just a totally normal day.
Right, exactly. You do the typical routine. You roll over, grab your phone off the nightstand, and, you know, you squint at the screen to check your notifications.
Probably expecting to see your overnight sales figures.
Yeah, exactly. But instead, you see an email from Amazon, and it is definitely not a sales report.
Oh, no.
Yeah. It's this sterile, completely automated message stating your seller account has been deactivated.
Just like that.
Just like that. There was no warning at all. There was no account manager calling to, like, clear things up. Just a bot-generated notice sitting in your inbox.
Which is just the worst feel.
And instantly, every single one of your product listings is just gone.
Yeah.
And the cash you had sitting in your seller account waiting to be paid out, frozen.
Completely locked up.
Right. If Amazon is the only place you sell, your entire business just flatlined overnight. Literally before you even had time to brew your morning coffee.
It is a genuinely terrifying scenario.
Mm.
And I think the most alarming part is just how common it has become.
Really?
Well, absolutely. This isn't some hypothetical thought experiment. It is the absolute reality of single-channel dependency in modern e-commerce.
Yes.
And it happens to incredibly successful businesses every single day.
And that is exactly the nightmare we are dismantling today. Welcome to the deep dive. For you listening, our topic today centers around a highly detailed breakdown by the team at SPC Tech.
Yeah, it's a great piece.
It's titled, Why Depending on One Platform is the Riskiest Move? And our mission for this deep dive is to extract the exact blueprint from this source for escaping this this single-channel trap.
And doing it without completely destroying your budget.
Right, exactly. We are going to walk through how to build that infrastructure in a way that doesn't bankrupt your cash flow or, you know, require you to hire some massive technical team.
Okay, let's unpack this.
So to really grasp the solution here, we first have to look at the structural fragility of relying on a single platform.
In technical terms, it's what we call a single point of failure. When your entire revenue stream flows through just one gatekeeper, you are essentially building a skyscraper on land you don't even own.
I always think about it like physical real estate. Like, building a multi-million dollar business solely on Amazon is kind of like running a highly profitable retail store, but one day you show up and your landlord has unilaterally changed the locks on your front door.
Yeah, that's a perfect analogy.
And not only can you not get in to sell your products, but the landlord also kept all the cash that was sitting in your register.
Right, they just hold on to it.
And because of the contract you signed to rent the space, you have virtually zero legal recourse to demand it back immediately. You just have to sit there, submit support tickets, and hope a faceless bureaucracy eventually releases your money.
And the real-world data from the SBC Tech Post really backs up that exact anxiety. Right now, over 2,000 sellers are suspended on Amazon every single month.
Wait, 2,000? Every month?
Every single month. And there's a specific development that makes this so much more dangerous than it was even a few years ago. In February 2026, Amazon rolled out an artificial intelligence system called Risk Shield.
Okay, I want to dig into that because Risk Shield sounds very, I don't know, clinical, but AI moderation is usually incredibly messy in practice.
Oh, it is. It really is.
So how does this system actually work under the hood?
Well, Risk Shield is designed to aggressively scan seller accounts for what Amazon deems risk signals.
Mm-hmm.
But instead of flagging an account for a human investigator to review.
Which is what they used to do, right?
Right. Exactly. But now, the AI has the authority to automatically suspend the account first and ask questions later.
Wow.
Yeah, it looks at these hidden variables, like a sudden spike in your return velocity, or maybe a slight discrepancy in the dimensional weight of your product at the fulfillment center, or even just a cluster of specific keywords in your buyer-seller messages. The algorithm detects a pattern it dislikes, and it pulls the plug on your listings instantly.
And when they pull that plug, what actually happens to the money? Like, if I need to pay my supplier on Friday and the AI flags me on Tuesday, can I still access my capital?
No, you absolutely cannot. Your funds are instantly frozen.
That's brutal.
It is. Amazon typically holds that cash for at least 60 days and sometimes well past 90 days.
Over 90 days. How do they justify that?
They cite the need to keep a reserve for potential customer refunds. So you aren't just out of sales, right?
Mm.
Your cash flow is completely severed, which means you default on your supplier invoices.
Okay, let me push back on this, though.
Sure.
Amazon is a behemoth. I mean, the consumer trust is deeply embedded into the app, the traffic is built in, and the logistics network handles the shipping flawlessly.
All true.
So if a brand is pulling in great numbers and the margins are healthy, why split your focus? Isn't it smarter to just dominate the biggest market rather than, you know, diluting your time trying to set up shop somewhere smaller?
What's fascinating here is the source text actually agrees with your premise. Well, to an extent anyway. Amazon is a phenomenal marketplace. It's arguably the best place to launch. The argument isn't that Amazon is bad.
Right.
The structural flaw is the 100% dependency. The SBC Tech research isolated sellers generating between $200,000 and $500,000 a month on Amazon.
So these aren't beginners.
Not at all. These are highly sophisticated operators. And they found that 47% of these sellers know they are dangerously exposed, but they take zero action.
Wait, almost half of them know it's a risk and do nothing.
Exactly. They suffer from operational complacency because, well, the daily payouts just feel so good.
Sorry, the cash is flowing.
Right. But the research for Miracle provides a pretty brutal reality check on what that complacency actually costs. They found that single-channel sellers max out at around $575,000 in average gross merchandise value.
So GMV, total sales volume.
Correct. Meanwhile, multi-channel sellers average over $10 million in GMV.
Wait, I want to pause on those numbers because that is a massive gap. $575,000 versus $10 million.
Huge difference, yeah.
That isn't just a slight bump in incremental sales. That is nearly a 20x multiplier. What is the actual mechanism driving that? I mean, is it simply that being in more digital stores equals more customers? Or is something else compounding there?
It's definitely a compounding effect, and it's based on customer journey overlap and operational resilience.
Okay, break that down for me.
Well, when you are single channel, you only capture the customer who explicitly goes and searches Amazon. But when you're multi-channel, a customer might discover your brand on TikTok, research your reviews on Amazon, but ultimately purchase on your Shopify site.
Oh, I see.
And when they buy on Shopify, you capture their email. So you start building an actual brand asset rather than just facilitating one-off transactions. Basically, single-channel sellers hit an algorithmic ceiling. Multi-channel sellers build a flywheel.
Okay, so if the goal is to hit that multi-million dollar flywheel and obviously avoid the sudden death of an AI suspension, a seller needs to know how close they are to the cliff edge right now.
Exactly.
And the source material outlines a specific way to measure this exposure, right?
Yes. It introduces the dependency metric. It is arguably the most vital key performance indicator in e-commerce, yet it rarely makes it onto a company's financial dashboard.
Which is crazy.
It really is. It's a straightforward calculation, honestly. Just what exact percentage of your total growth revenue is generated by a single platform?
It sounds elementary, but I can see how when you are bogged down in the daily grind of, you know, checking conversion rates and ad spend, zooming out to look at macro platform dependency just gets ignored.
Completely ignored. The text actually categorizes this metric into a sort of risk thermometer.
Okay, let's hear the thermometer.
So if your primary channel accounts for under 50% of your total revenue, your foundation is solid. If Amazon goes down for a month, I mean, it is going to hurt your profitability, but you will still make payroll. You can still pay your warehouse staff and keep the lights on.
Right. Your business takes a hit, but it doesn't die.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Then you have the 50 to 70% range. This is manageable, but it requires active intervention. You have small buffer, but a sustained suspension will force you into severe debt.
And then the red zone?
The true danger zone is anything above 80%. If 80% of your cash comes from one gatekeeper, you do not own a business. You own a highly volatile income stream that can be terminated by a line of code.
Wow.
One policy update on how reviews are displayed, or one risk shield flag, and it puts you right into bankruptcy territory.
For you listening, if you run an e-commerce brand, or you manage operations for one, seriously, make it a priority this week to calculate that dependency KPI. Pull your revenue for the trailing 12 months and find out exactly what percentage is sitting on rented land.
It's so important.
Because you cannot strategize a way out of the trap until you quantify the exposure. So what does this all mean?
Well, it means if you run that calculation and find yourself in that danger zone, the mandate is clear. You have to diversify. You need a multi-channel infrastructure.
But this is where I feel like the industry terminology creates a massive roadblock for people.
Oh, the jargon is terrible.
Right. Brands hear they need to diversify, and they immediately get overwhelmed by these software pitches promising omni-channel integration. We need to delineate between multi-channel an omnichannel.
Yes, we really do.
Let's use a physical analogy to separate these two, because the tech jargon gets dense.
I love a good analogy.
Think of a multi-channel strategy like owning a burger joint, a taco stand, and a pizza place.
Okay, I'm hungry now, but go on.
They are geographically spread out across town. You own all three, and they all drive revenue for you, but structurally, they are siloed. The manager at the burger joint has no idea how much inventory the taco stand has, and they certainly don't share a cash register.
That perfectly captures the operational reality of multi-channel.
Right. Now, omni-channel, by contrast, is like building a multi-million dollar automated central kitchen that powers all three restaurants simultaneously.
Which is incredibly complex.
Exactly. If a customer buys a pizza on the east side of town, the central software instantly knows what they ordered, updates their universal loyalty points, and deducts the exact ounces of flour from the master inventory list so the burger joint knows what supplies are left.
Right.
Everything is deeply technically synchronized.
And that distinction is crucial. In digital terms, omnichannel requires an enterprise resource planning system, an ERP.
Which sounds expensive.
It is. Mm-hmm. It requires complex API integrations that allow your Shopify site, your Amazon seller account, and your third-party logistics warehouses to all talk to each other in real time. It is highly expensive and very prone to technical bugs during setup.
Right.
So the relief provided by the SPC tech source is this. You do not need an omni-channel setup on day one.
So you don't need to build the expensive central kitchen just to open your second restaurant.
Exactly. Multi-channel is the perfect starting point. You simply establish outposts on other platforms. You manage the inventory for Amazon separately from the inventory you send to Walmart.
Okay.
It stops your overdependency immediately, without requiring some $50,000 software overhaul.
That makes the barrier to entry so much lower.
Yeah.
But we still need a tactical execution plan. We know we are building separate storefronts, but if I'm a business owner, how do I actually execute this without stretching my team so thin that our customer service just completely collapses?
The source outlines a very deliberate four-step rollout playbook, and it's designed specifically to prevent that kind of operational collapse.
Okay, let's hear step one.
Step one is to sequence your rollout based on your current revenue and your product identity.
Right, because launching on three new platforms simultaneously guarantees you will fail at all of them. So what is the recommended sequencing?
So if your brand is generating between $200,000 and $350,000 a month on Amazon, the most logical first step is Walmart.
Why Walmart?
Because the mechanics of selling on Walmart closely mirror Amazon. Specifically, Walmart Fulfillment Services, or WFS, operates almost identically to Amazon FBA.
Okay.
You ship your pallets to their warehouse, and they handle the pick, pack, and shipping. The search algorithms prioritize similar variables, but the seller base is much smaller on Walmart, meaning there's less saturation for those page one rankings.
So it's the passive least resistance because the logistics model is something the seller already understands.
Precisely. Now, once revenue crosses the $350,000 to $500,000 threshold, the playbook shifts to launching a dedicated Shopify site.
Okay, making your own site.
Right. At that volume, you really need to start owning the checkout experience and avoiding marketplace referral fees.
Makes sense.
And then, if you have a product that is highly visual, like cosmetics or apparel, the text recommends integrating TikTok Shop.
Because of the video aspect.
Yeah, you leverage user-generated content and Spark ads to hit a demographic that simply isn't typing product names into an Amazon search bar. They're scrolling.
Right, totally different behavior.
And finally, for niche, vintage, or highly specialized items, eBay and Etsy are identified as the fastest routes to secondary cash flow.
So step one is essentially choosing the right battlefield based on your product and your size. What is step two?
Step two involves a very aggressive technical hurdle, and that is syncing your pricing and inventory.
Okay.
This is where Amazon really wields its market power. If you launch on Walmart and your product is listed for, say, $1 less on Walmart, Amazon's automated scraping bots will find it.
Wait, I want to clarify the mechanism there. Amazon actively deploys bots across the wider internet to monitor your prices on competing websites.
They absolutely do. They scan the web looking for your specific UPC barcodes.
Wow.
If they detect that you are offering a better deal on Walmart or even your own Shopify site, Amazon will suppress your buy box.
That's aggressive. And for anyone unfamiliar, the buy box is that default add to cart button on the Amazon product page where roughly 80% of all sales actually happen.
Yeah, losing it is huge.
Right. If you lose that, the customer has to click through a secondary menu just to find your offer, which basically kills your conversion rate overnight.
It is a severe penalty. so your pricing architecture must be identical across platforms. Or you must use different multi-packs and bundles on Walmart so the UPC codes just don't directly match what you sell on Amazon.
Ah, that's a smart workaround. Okay, moving to step three.
Step three, the text strongly advises testing small. You only launch 5 to 10 of your highest performing products on the new channel.
I can hear founders screaming through their headphones at that advice.
Oh, for sure. They hate it.
Right. They're saying, if I am going through the legal and operational friction to open a Walmart seller account, why on earth wouldn't I upload my entire 150 product catalog on day one to maximize my potential revenue?
It is the most common temptation, and it leads directly to operational bloat.
How so?
Well, when you move to a new platform, the formatting rules change. Your product descriptions might get truncated. The shipping dimensions you imported might be slightly off in Walmart's system, resulting in massive unexpected fulfillment fees.
Oh, I see.
If you launch 150 products, you multiply those errors by 150.
That would be a night.
Testing a 5 to 10 ASIN catalog, meaning just a handful of unique item numbers, gives you manageable data. You figure out the platform's unique return policies and search algorithms before you risk all your profit margins.
Right, so you are containing the blast radius while you learn the ropes. Makes perfect sense. And the final step?
Step four is committing to a 90-day runway. You simply cannot evaluate a new platform's viability in the first month.
Because the algorithm doesn't know who you are yet.
Exactly. You have no sales history, no reviews on that specific platform, and no seller authority. You have to endure a season of low traction to build index authority. So many sellers launch on Shopify, see zero organic traffic in the first 3 weeks, panic, and then just retreat back to the comfort of Amazon. You have to give the infrastructure a full quarter to breathe.
Taking a step back here, building out Walmart, Shopify, and TikTok creates a fantastic safety net.
It does.
But Walmart and TikTok are still massive corporations with their own completely opaque algorithms.
Absolutely.
They could roll out their own version of Risk Shield tomorrow. So where is the ultimate security in all this?
Well, if we connect this to the bigger picture, the ultimate safeguard isn't just about changing platforms.
Okay.
It is about crossing the chasm from a rented audience to an owned audience.
Break down the functional difference between the two.
So, a rented audience is anyone you reach through a third-party gatekeeper. Your Amazon buyers, your Instagram followers, your organic search traffic on Google.
Because you don't actually own the connection to them.
Exactly. You are borrowing access to those people. And the platform dictates the cost of that access, which, by the way, almost always goes up over time.
Naturally.
But an owned audience consists of first-party data. It is your email list. It is your SMS text database. It's the customer profiles living inside your Shopify backend. No algorithm can suddenly decide to charge you more money to send an email to a customer who explicitly opted in.
And the return on investment metrics really reflect that freedom, don't they?
Oh, the data is staggering. The SBC Tech text notes that email marketing averages a $36 return for every single dollar spent.
36 to 1.
Yes. You cannot achieve that kind of return on ad spend on Amazon or Facebook anymore because the customer acquisition costs are just too high now.
Wow.
Additionally, a Harvard Business Review study cited in the research points out that 73% of shoppers utilize multiple channels during the research phase.
Walk me through the mechanics of that cross-channel journey. How does owning an email list leverage that 73%?
Well, let's say a customer sees a TikTok video about your product. They don't buy immediately. Instead, they go to Amazon to read the reviews because they trust Amazon's review ecosystem.
Right, we all do that.
They add it to their cart, but then they get distracted and abandon it. Now, if you have an owned audience mechanism in place, maybe they visited your site earlier and gave you their email for a digital guide, you can hit their inbox the very next morning with a 10% discount directly to your Shopify store.
Oh, nice.
You intercept the customer during the research phase using a communication channel that costs you fractions of a cent to utilize.
The major friction point here, though, is the walled garden of Amazon.
Yeah, it's a big wall.
If 85% of our brand sales are happening on Amazon, how do they actually capture that first-party data? I mean, Amazon strips the customer email addresses from the order reports. They don't want you talking to their customers.
And Amazon's terms of service are aggressively strict about this. If you put a flyer in your packaging that says, buy your next order on our website for 20% off, Amazon will ban you for attempting to siphon their traffic.
Right. So what's the workaround?
The workaround requires offering post-purchase utility.
Meaning you have to give the customer a reason to seek you out off-platform that doesn't violate the rules.
Correct. And the most effective, fully compliant tactic outlined in the source is using insert cards with QR codes inside the physical product packaging.
But the QR code does not offer a discount.
Exactly. It offers a warranty activation or a free digital instruction manual or maybe a video guide on how to assemble the product.
Ah, I see. The customer gets the box, scans the QR code for the setup video, and that code lands them on a page you own. Well, to watch the video, they enter their email. Boom. A rented Amazon buyer is successfully converted into an owned asset.
You got it. And from that moment on, you feed them into automated email and SMS post-purchase flows. You invite them to a loyalty program.
Yeah.
You are actively pulling the life cycle of that customer away from the Amazon search bar and into your own ecosystem.
Here's where it gets really interesting. Once you actually own that list of emails and phone numbers, it completely neutralizes the threat of the AI risk shield we discussed at the top of the show.
It completely disarms it.
Right. If the algorithm suddenly suspends your Amazon account on a random Tuesday, your company doesn't flatline. You pivot. You send an email blast to your own audience stating, hey, we are experiencing technical issues on our Amazon storefront, but you can order directly from our warehouse today. You bypass the gatekeeper entirely.
That is the ultimate definition of business resilience.
Yeah.
The objective of this deep dive isn't to convince anyone to abandon Amazon. Like we said, it is the most powerful retail engine on the internet.
Definitely.
The objective is to ensure that Amazon isn't the only engine keeping your plane in the air.
To synthesize the blueprint for everyone listening, first, calculate your dependency metric this week. Quantify exactly how much revenue is sitting on one platform.
Crucial first step.
Second, if you are over that 50% threshold, execute the four-step rollout. Sequence the platform to match your revenue, starting with Walmart or Shopify. Sync your inventory to avoid pricing penalties. Test the waters with 5 to 10 products and give the algorithms a 90-day runway to index your brand.
Yep.
And finally, use compliant post-purchase utility to convert rented traffic into an owned email list.
The psychology of this is honestly just as important as the tactics. Human nature dictates that when profits are high and operations are smooth, we don't want to change anything.
Obviously.
You have to build a lifeboat while the ship is sailing in calm waters. The absolute worst time to try and build a Shopify site is the morning after your primary channel gets suspended.
Which brings us back to that risk shield AI system Amazon deployed. We know algorithms are already scanning variables, analyzing metrics, and automatically shuttering businesses before a human investigator even clocks in for the day.
It's already happened.
So I want to leave you with a thought to mull over as we wrap up. As artificial intelligence models become increasingly sophisticated at predicting consumer behavior and assessing risk, how long until these systems stop merely policing the rules and start actually dictating the market?
That's a scary thought.
Are we approaching an era where opaque algorithms determine not just who is allowed to sell, but exactly what types of products are permitted to reach the public?
Wow.
Think about what it means for the future of commerce if owning your direct audience isn't just a marketing hack, but the absolute only way to survive algorithmic retail. We will catch you on the next deep dive.